Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and at 13 hours GMT on Tuesday, the 2nd of July, these are our main stories. In Gaza, hundreds of thousands of people are reported to be on the move because of the latest Israeli evacuation orders. As he's sent to prison, Donald Trump's former aide, Steve Bannon, says he has a MAGA army to stop Democrats winning the White House again.
And they've never seen an army like this, and they're going to fight for every ballot.
Also in this podcast, a new government in the Netherlands, headed by a former spy, is sworn in. And a trailblazing Paris drag club that inspired a Hollywood movie shuts its doors. As Israeli forces continue to bombard southern parts of Gaza, many people have been fleeing the largely ruined city of Khan Yunis after being ordered to by the Israeli military. Health officials say 8 people were killed and dozens wounded during Israeli overnight strikes in and around the city. The UN says Israel's latest mass evacuation orders have affected 250,000 people. Many of those on the move are exhausted as they've had to pack up their belongings repeatedly to try to escape the violence.
We should evacuate out of the eastern parts of Khan Yunis. Where should we go? Tell us where to go. When we were displaced from Rafah, we had to spend 2 weeks out in the open.
We seek peace, not war. Enough is enough. We are slowly dying. This is unfair. What is our fault? We are innocent civilians.
Patients and medical staff have also been leaving the European Gaza Hospital in the area. Sebastian Usher gave us this update from Jerusalem.
What we've been hearing really for the past 12 hours or so, since the evacuation order, first by audio message and then online, was issued by the Israeli military, this is the eastern outskirts of Khan Yunis. These are towns and villages from which Israel said around 20 projectiles were fired on Monday morning, and they went into Israel. It's the largest barrage of rockets that have come from Gaza since January. Islamic Jihad, one of the main factions beside Hamas, said that it was responsible. And overnight, the Israeli army said that it carried out strikes that were targeted on weapons storage and operational infrastructure, presumably the Palestinian fighters. Now, the evacuation order led to a large number of residents, many of whom had returned. They'd already fled to Rafah, which is further south, when Khan Yunis was the focus of the Israeli operation. But since Rafah became perhaps the last major operation that Israel's carrying out, they moved back to Khan Yunis, even though much of it was destroyed. In some cases, people couldn't even really find where their homes were. Now they're on the move again. Israel's essentially told them to go to the west of Khan Yunis, to Al-Mawasi. This is an area where there are tents. It's been essentially a place that Israel has said throughout the conflict it's safe for Palestinians from all parts of Gaza to go to, but it's overcrowded, lacks supplies, and people are wondering if it's really any better to be there than where they are now.
Sebastian Usher. Meanwhile, across Israel, large protests have been taking place in ultra-Orthodox Jewish communities following a historic Supreme Court ruling last week that their young men should be drafted into the military. A legal amendment that previously gave exemptions to full-time students at Jewish seminaries recently expired, and the Israeli Attorney General has said the army should take on new ultra-Orthodox recruits from this week. Our Middle East correspondent, Yolande Nell, has been following the demonstrations.
When the ultra-Orthodox or Haredi Jewish community gathers in force, you realise just how big it is. The streets in this part of Jerusalem are packed out with men in their distinctive white shirts with black suits and broad-brimmed hats. And they're vehemently opposed to the Supreme Court ruling that says they can now be drafted to the military.
For 2,000 years we've been persecuted and we've survived because we're learning Torah. And now the Supreme Court wants to remove this from us, and it will cause our destruction.
The draft does not help militarily. They don't want us Haredim, us Orthodox Jews. They don't need us. They're just going to give us some dirty job there. They're there to make us not Orthodox no longer.
The ultra-Orthodox say their prayers and dedication to religious study protect Israel. During the early days of the state, a few hundred Jewish seminary students were given exemptions from compulsory army service. But now, with the high birth rate, the ultra-Orthodox populations are millions strong. More than 60,000 young men are eligible for conscription. This issue of sharing the security burden has long divided religious and secular Jewish Israelis. Berating Israel's national security advisor at a conference, Mor Shamgar's son is a tank commander who served some 200 days as a reservist since Israel began its war against Hamas in Gaza. The fighting is putting a huge strain on military manpower. Because the Prime Minister's party relies on an alliance with ultra-Orthodox parties to stay in power, Moore says it's ducked dealing with the draft.
Netanyahu and his gang made a major judgment mistake on thinking they can dodge it, because once you enforce on half the population that you have to go to the army, you cannot enforce on the other half that they will not go to the army. I look at it as an equality issue.
Men of different ages are draped in their prayer shawls, gathering for the morning service at this ultra-Orthodox synagogue in Jerusalem. So far, just one Israeli army battalion tries to accommodate their demands for gender segregation with time set aside for prayers and Torah study. But Yoshua Pfeffer, an ultra-Orthodox rabbi who works on issues of integration, believes his community must compromise and let more of its young generation serve.
It's up to the Haredim to come to the table and say, we're ready for real concessions. These are the terms that we need to allow, at the very least, these thousands of boys who are not in full-time Torah study to participate in army service, just like other boys who are defending the Jewish people in Israel today.
Back at the protest, there are some who take an extreme position, throwing stones at the police and even the cars of some ultra-Orthodox politicians who they feel have let them down on military conscription. Amid rising social pressure in Israel and the possibility of widening war, change appears unavoidable.
That report by our Middle East correspondent, Yoland Nell. President Biden has criticized a U.S. Supreme Court ruling that gave Donald Trump partial immunity from criminal prosecution, saying it sets a dangerous precedent. The landmark decision is likely to delay Mr. Trump's trial for interfering in the 2020 election. Meanwhile, Mr. Trump's former chief strategist, Steve Bannon, has begun serving a four-month prison term for defying a congressional subpoena. Mr. Bannon described himself as a political prisoner as he arrived at the low-security federal jail. Speaking to the BBC's Sarah Smith before his imprisonment, Mr. Bannon said he remained focused on raising a so-called MAGA army to contest the result of the 2024 presidential vote, and that being behind bars wouldn't change that.
If I have to do it in a prison, I do it in a prison. It makes no difference at all.
You've talked yourself about investigating, prosecuting, maybe even incarcerating some of the people who've been involved in prosecuting Donald Trump. Yeah. What for?
We are going to go after what is the deep state. It's a term I never use, but actually as I spent more time combating it, it's very true. It's this combination of the intelligence agencies, the law enforcement, things like the FBI, Justice Department, CIA, DNI, the military, etc., that have to be investigated, have to be thoroughly investigated by the rule of law and with under the Constitution to get us back to a constitutional republic, but to see exactly, for instance, like Merrick Garland will be a top target.
So what Merrick Garland's the Attorney General?
Yes, Attorney General.
And you want him to be investigated and prosecuted? What for?
Only if the investigation turns to something. If investigations turn up the receipts or turn up things that should be prosecuted, we should definitely turn it over to criminal prosecution.
But Donald Trump complains, and you do too, that the Biden administration
I never complain. I make facts. No, they've weaponized the government. Of course they
have. But you're talking about doing the same thing if you want to prosecute investigations against anybody who was involved in that.
It's totally different. We're not weaponizing the government. We're going to have a you know, either congressional panels. This will all be done inside the rules as they exist today. Either congressional panels, congressional investigation, oversight committees, judiciary committee, plus, if it has to be, special prosecutors, special counsels, things that are totally inside the rule of law. So this is not, we're not going to be extrajudicial. We're
Do
not
you want to see President Biden prosecuted?
I want to see President Biden prosecuted now. I think he's selling out the country.
And we're still several months away from the election.
Yes.
Do you accept it is possible that Joe Biden could fairly win the election in November?
Impossible.
But if you say it's impossible for him to win fairly,
he didn't win.
You're declaring now, are you, that if he's declared the winner in November, you will claim that the election's been stolen?
He didn't win in 2020. He's totally and completely illegitimate. This show, our audience, have never wavered from this, ever.
You know that there were 60 court cases in which judges found no evidence of any widespread electoral
fraud. That is not true. They didn't have standing. They did not have standing. That's not true. This has never been adjudicated.
But looking ahead to this November, if he's declared the winner, how do you say declared winner?
Declared winner by certification by the states? He will not get certified by the states. He would not have been certified by the states last time if we didn't have the fiasco of January 6th.
You are telling supporters that they need to get ready to fight back if 100%. The Democrats try to steal the election. So what does that mean?
We mean just like in tables less like this. Remember, it's not votes, it's ballots. Right now, we've trained up an army of poll workers, poll watchers, election officials. We have been training up for years. Lawyers are going to be ready, and this time they're going to have their filings ready to go, and they'll be outside the courthouse. And they've never seen an army like this. And they're going to fight for every ballot. They're going to make sure none of this bogus mail-in ballots with no return address, nothing that comes in 3 weeks later. We're playing by tight rules, and a lot of those we've been able through state legislatures to change. So our people are going to be on the trigger, metaphorically, to fight this from day one.
Former Trump strategist, now convicted felon, Steve Bannon, speaking to Sarah Smith. Let's turn to Cambodia now, where 10 activists from an environmental group that's campaigned against destructive infrastructure projects and alleged corruption have each been given six-year prison sentences on charges of conspiring against the state. Some received an extra 2 years after being convicted of insulting Cambodia's king. The activists all deny the charges, which they say are politically motivated. Our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Celia Hatton, told me more.
Well, this is quite a feisty group of activists who belong to a group called Mother Nature, which has won a lot of awards internationally because they really were a bit different in Cambodia. They use quite peaceful means to document environmental destruction in Cambodia. So, for example, a couple of them were arrested right before the trial, trying to document the pumping of raw sewage into one of Cambodia's main rivers. They also had some success shutting down huge environmental projects. There was a hydroelectric dam. They stopped the construction of that in 2014. But they were also very clear that they wanted to blame the environmental destruction and the kind of breakneck growth that was taking place in Cambodia on a group they say were Cambodia's corrupt elite. And they were very clear that they thought it was a real dictatorship taking over in Cambodia that really didn't care about the environment. And so seeing them sentenced today for plotting against the government, I think the group, even though they deny the charges, they would be clear that they're not just against sticking up for Cambodia's environment, but also sticking up for Cambodia as a whole against this increasingly corrupt government.
And the exploitation of Cambodia's natural resources has long been a contentious issue.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Cambodia is a stunning place. It's full of biodiversity. It's got a lot of natural resources. But it's really at a crossroads because, as I said, it's undergoing breakneck development, especially in the past couple of decades. There's been a huge influx of Chinese investment that's really hard to kind of document. And so there's been deforestation at a rapid scale. We're seeing things like sand mining, the dredging up of sand from the seabed that's led to a lot of flooding along Cambodia's coastlines. And so the problem is, though, it's not just environmental destruction, but groups like Mother Nature are really raising questions about who is profiting from this kind of development that's taking place.
Celia Hatton. The two-time Wimbledon champion Andy Murray had been hoping to have another shot at trying to win the tournament before bowing out later this year after the Paris Olympics. But the tennis star has now revealed he will not be competing in the men's singles, although he'll still play in the doubles. His involvement had been thrown into doubt after he had back surgery less than 2 weeks ago. Our reporter, Delef Lloyd, is at Centre Court in Wimbledon.
It's the news that no tennis fan and certainly no Andy Murray fan wanted to hear, but confirmation at the All England Club that the two-time Wimbledon champion Andy Murray has had to withdraw from the men's singles. Just 10 days ago, Murray had a large cyst removed from near his spinal cord and faced a race against time to be fit for what would have been his final appearance at Wimbledon in the singles. He'd been practicing on the practice courts here over the last few days. He kept pushing back a decision on whether to play. The All England Club had tried to give him every chance to recover as he was scheduled to play third on centre court this Tuesday against Czech Tomáš Macháč. Murray, however, will play doubles with his brother Jamie. In a statement released by his team, said Andy has taken the very difficult decision not to play the singles this year. As you can imagine, he is extremely disappointed, but has confirmed that he will be playing in the doubles with Jamie and looks forward to competing at Wimbledon for the last time.
He will be disappointed, as will his fans, but he does have a legacy to look back on that he can be proud of.
An absolutely huge legacy. Andy Murray in his prime was one of the original big four, along with Roger Federer, Rafael Nadal and Novak Djokovic. His Wimbledon victory over Djokovic here on centre court back in 2013 ended a 77-year wait for the British men's champion at Wimbledon. Those emotional scenes that day will never be forgotten. His first Grand Slam title had come 10 months before at the US Open in New York, where his understated shock at winning the title won him even more fans around the world. He added another Wimbledon title to his tally in 2016. He also reached the Australian Open final on five occasions and the French Open final in 2016. He ended that year as the world number one and by being knighted a Sir. Back surgeries and hip surgeries followed in the years after, which hampered his ability to reach the very top of his game again, but he was a very much loved player among his peers. He also led Great Britain to a Davis Cup victory in 2015, a first for Great Britain in 79 years, and won back-to-back Olympic singles titles in 2012 and 2016. It's maybe fitting that he will end his career next month at the Paris Games for one final farewell.
Delef Lloyd. Still to come.
And most excitingly for us, or I find this very exciting, is that we get these ancient air bubbles entombed in the ice sheet, and these are a direct sample of the atmosphere from the time that snow fell.
Meet the scientists finding ancient pockets of trapped air in layers of ice. You're listening to the Global News Podcast. The new government of the Netherlands has been sworn in by King Willem-Alexander almost a year after the previous one collapsed. The right-wing coalition is made up of four parties, the largest led by the anti-immigration politician Geert Wilders. But Mr. Wilders won't be prime minister despite his anti-immigration Freedom Party coming first in last year's election. Instead, a former intelligence chief, Dick Schoof, is taking over from Mark Rutte, the country's longest-serving leader. Our correspondent, Anna Holligan, who's outside the Prime Minister's residence, the Little Tower, told us more.
Mark Rutte will be moving out today in a kind of ceremonial exit, and Dick Schoof will move in. So he was actually supposed to retire in March. He stayed on to be Prime Minister of this four-party coalition. There was a meme going round at the time when his name first came to prominence in connection with the role of Prime Minister, saying, "You might not know who he is, but he knows who you are." He's the former head of the Dutch intelligence service. He is no longer aligned with a party. And what they've managed to do in order to create this right-wing coalition, which for many months people thought would never actually come into being because of the kind of arguments between the parties, but they've managed to create three new ministries, so each of the parties gets a ministry which is kind of linked to its own special interests. So, for example, the farmer citizen movement will lead the agriculture and fisheries ministry. Dick Schoof, he has a background in immigration. He was seen to be responsible for reducing an influx of refugees during the conflict in the Balkans. And one of the reasons why this coalition has come to power is something that we've seen right across the continent. People frustrated with a perceived inability of the more traditional parties to manage things like the asylum crisis, the cost of living crisis, the green transition. So this is really seen as symptomatic of a sentiment, a public sentiment that exists here in the Netherlands, but also in places, of course, like France and possibly even the UK too.
Anna Holligan. Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban has arrived in Ukraine. His visit, his first since Russia's full-scale invasion 2 years ago, has come as a surprise to some, given his warm relationship with Vladimir Putin and his attempts to block or water down Western support for Kyiv. Our Europe regional editor, Paul Moss, told us more about why Mr. Orban was in Ukraine.
The background to this is that Viktor Orban has been, as you said, an ally of Vladimir Putin and perhaps more of a problem to Ukraine than almost any other European leader. He blocked EU aid packages to Ukraine. He objected to NATO helping Ukraine. He's opposed Ukraine joining the European Union and NATO. And why? Well, as you said, he's always been an ally of Vladimir Putin. He sees him as an ideological soulmate. In fact, Viktor Orban is one of the few Western leaders to congratulate Vladimir Putin on winning his election. An election which most other people thought was rigged. In other words, Viktor Orban, you would think, would be about as welcome in Kyiv as a Russian parachute regiment. However, since Monday, Viktor Orban has been head of the European Union's revolving presidency. So he and President Zelensky really do have to deal with each other, hence him making what is his first visit to Ukraine since Russia invaded.
So what does he mean about a ceasefire?
It's hard to know, isn't it? He just came out with this thing. He said, I've suggested to President Zelensky there should be a quick ceasefire and said that this would speed up peace talks. Now, I don't think that idea is going to go down very well in Kyiv because they've always thought in Ukraine any talk of a ceasefire would just be an opportunity for Russia to build up its military, to make more equipment and to conscript more soldiers. You know, there are signs in the West that in some places support for Ukraine is waning. There's obviously the good chance that President Trump will be in the White House in January, who's never been keen on supporting Ukraine. So it suits Vladimir Putin very much to play for time.
Mr. Orban's ceasefire idea, how has that gone down, given all this, with Ukraine's president?
Well, you know, Volodymyr Zelensky is always a diplomat, isn't he? He said that same joint press conference, it was important for Europe to maintain military support for Ukraine. He said important to help them defend against what he called Russian terror. Now, what he said about the ceasefire idea in private to Mr. Zelensky, we don't know. But one assumes the two of them may have been rather more candid with each other when they weren't standing in front of the world's media.
Paul Moss. Sudan's brutal civil war over the last year has devastated the country and caused one of the world's worst humanitarian crises. Now the paramilitary group, the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, has made further military gains in the southeastern state of Sennar. It seized most of the town of Sinjar, sending more than 55,000 civilians fleeing, according to the UN. Mahanand El Bilal runs the aid initiative Khartoum Aid Kitchen and spoke to James Copnell.
Jebel Moya is a very strategic location. It allows the RSF to attack at will several locations within Sinjar state. Now, what happened initially was that they attacked the city of Sinjar, and that attack was repulsed. And there were celebrations within the city, and also the head of the Sovereignty Council and the head of the army, Burhan, showed up in the city. And there was belief that that was an indication that Sinjar would be defended. Just within hours of Burhan leaving Sinjar state, the RSF attacked Sinjar, and people were hopeful that the city would be defended, but that didn't happen. The army basically vacated. It was they did not put up a proper fight, and civilians were abandoned. What's happened since is harrowing, and we keep on repeating the same story of seeing army withdrawals, the RSF moving in, and civilians having to experience the most horrific atrocities. One of the examples I've heard is of a young girl. She's called Dana Bashir. She was 6 years old. The RSF heard that her father was an officer, and they presumed he was a military officer. So they went to his house, and they shot her dead because who they believed her father to be. Now, Turns out her father was an agricultural officer. Now, we are witnessing a calamitous amount of atrocities being committed on the Sudanese people, and the army is simply not defending.
Why is that? Why is the army unable then to defend key locations? We've seen this in Darfur, we've seen this in the capital Khartoum, we've seen this in Jazeera State, now in Sana'a. Why is the army not able to get to grips with the task?
Part of it is incompetence, and part of it is a desire to favour strategic locations rather than actually protect civilians. So it's a military doctrine that needs changing. Internationally, we're not seeing any real pressure on the RSF to actually prevent these crimes.
Mohanad El Bilal from Khartoum Aid Kitchen. Now, take a listen to this. This is what air that's been trapped in ice for thousands of years sounds like. At the Summer Science Exhibition at the Royal Society in London, a piece of ice is being displayed. It was drilled, taken from a few hundred metres down, where air was trapped for perhaps 10,000 years. It's now part of an exhibition about the effects of climate change on Antarctica. Amy King is a postdoctorate researcher working in the Ice Core Gas Analysis Lab at the British Antarctic Survey and spoke to Amal Rajan.
Antarctica is this incredibly vast and pristine landscape that's made up of year upon year, layer upon layer of snow falling on top of each other. And the overlying weight of this volume of snow compresses the lower layers into ice. So we have these old layers at the bottom and then upwards traveling chronologically to the snow layers at the top, which are the youngest layers. So as ice core scientists, we go and drill down through these layers. We get this vertical cylinder of ice to retrieve these ancient layers. And most excitingly for us, or I find this very exciting, is that we get these ancient air bubbles entombed in the ice sheet. And these are a direct sample of the atmosphere from the time that that snow fell. So basically as good as if we went outside with a plastic bottle today and put the cap on, that's what's in our air bubbles. So we can go and measure loads of really interesting elements from the atmosphere and from the climate in these air bubbles. One really important example is our greenhouse gases. I think most of your listeners will be aware how important these are in our current and future climate. And much of our understanding of how these gases are behaving in our atmosphere currently comes from these records. And amazingly, these records, these ice core records, can go back to 800,000 years ago. So we really learn a lot from these ancient bubbles.
Absolutely fascinating. And just briefly, if you would, Dr. King, what have you learned about the effect of climate change today? What's your research yielded about what's happening now?
Well, so one really important finding we're showcasing at the Summer Science Exhibition, it comes from a record from an ice core SkyTrain ice rise. And this shows us a record of the last 20,000 years. So 20,000 years ago, the Earth was coming out of an ice age, and we've been gradually warming since then. So we measured lots of elements in the ice core that tells us about how the Antarctic ice sheet was behaving. And around, what we see is around 8,000 years ago, the ice sheet lost about 400 metres of elevation in only 200 years. So this is a massive loss of ice, which we know was driven by this warming. Okay. So this is really important to understand, because we now know that this is a potential event that could happen in the future if we don't stem the emissions and the warming going into the future.
Amy King from the British Antarctic Survey. 68 years after it burst onto the Parisian nightlife scene, Chez Michou, the trailblazing drag cabaret that inspired the French comedy film La Cage aux Folles and the Hollywood movie Birdcage, has announced its closing. Terry Egan reports.
Succès foudroyant cette année, les spectacles burlesques de travestis.
Just some of the atmosphere from Chez Michou, which opened in 1956, well-placed in the northern Montmartre district of Paris and featuring male caricatures of female personalities, the nightclub could be said to have introduced France to drag entertainment. But despite being Paris's smallest cabaret, it nevertheless held its own against more conventional venues, such as Moulin Rouge and the Crazy Horse, and was famous for its own versions of big-name performers, including Dalida and Liza Minnelli. The Transvestite Cabaret was launched by the icon of French culture it was named after, Michu, whose real name was Michel Catti. Famous for his big tinted glasses and blue outfits, he died in 2020, but not before inspiring the comedy film La Cage aux Folles, which was later remade as The Birdcage with Robin Williams.
Don't use that tone to me.
What tone?
That sarcastic, contemptuous tone that means you know everything because you're a man and I know nothing because I'm a woman.
You're not a woman.
Oh.
But it was competitors, perhaps, attracting a younger, more revved-up audience, which meant that Chez Michu lost bookings and struggled financially. Either way, Sunday's show was its last. The mascara has run and the vanity lights look to have flickered out. At least for now.
That report by Terry Egan. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast, email us. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. This edition was produced by Harry Bly. It was mixed by Chris Hansen. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janet Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.